There. My name is Jennifer Turner, and I know you're going to be a little confused, but I direct the China Environment Forum at the Woodrow Wilson Center. So I do China stuff on energy and environment and climate. I don't speak Korean. I do actually have two sisters-in-law from Korea, so that just to confuse things. So, so two family members married Korean. So I have a little Korean in my family, so that's why I know how to say 안녕하세요. Really, and I could say 한계주세요 비빔밥 and 감사합니다, and we're done with my Korean. I'm very excited to be here. And at first, I was confused when Brookings invited me, but then I was excited because I focus on China. And here in D.C., when you talk about climate and Asia, everyone says China, right? China, the number one greenhouse gas emitter in the world, and you know, are they doing enough? And yes, they are. Maybe not. And then there's Korea. And I know that Korea is actually really moving and working to become a leader in climate issues. And so I thought, well, this is a good opportunity not only to highlight this trend, not saying it's 100% successful, we'll find out, but also so for my own personal selfish gain to understand what Korea is doing. Because, you know, I think there could be some opportunities networking between China and Korea. So what we have today is a panel called Korea's Leadership on Global Issues, Green Economy, and Climate Change. I've got three speakers, and I've been very strict with them. I've told them they have 15 minutes. They stop talking because your job in the audience is going to be to ask difficult questions. Now, I don't know. See, this is your homework. You have to pay attention and ask challenging questions because I know that maybe a lot of you are not energy and climate people, but it is a matter that is important for the world to be an environmentalist kind of person sounding up here. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off with, and I'm going to do my best not to mangle everyone's names. We're going to start off with Dr. Soo-young Chung, who's an associate professor at Korea University, and he's going to take us on a quick review of Korea's leadership on the climate issue and green economy. So that's looking more about what Korea is doing on climate mitigation, right, to prevent it from coming out. And not that she's negative, but Soo-min Chung, she's an associate professor of geography at University of Kansas. She's done some really fascinating work that's going to be, you're going to have to tell us where it's going to be published, but on looking at climate adaptation. If you're not familiar with the term, that basically means climate impacts are going to happen. How can we adapt? How can we cope? How can we be resilient? And fascinatingly enough, is doing a comparison between what France and Korea are doing in terms of their planning. And then we have Jay Ko, who's a managing director and partner at Siegler Guff, that he's kind of from the more business angle, because how do you pay for all this, right? So I'm not going to steal his thunder about what he's going to talk about. So you understand the plan here? They're going to talk quickly, succinctly, and compellingly, and you are getting ready to ask difficult questions when it's done, and I'll guide you in the discussion. Does it sound like we've got a good compact, social compact here this afternoon? All right, because it's after lunch, they're going to get sleepy. Got to keep it moving. All right. Professor Chung. Let's welcome him.
Thank you. This is such unusual, I think, for us to discuss about the non-traditional security issues such as climate change in Washington, D.C. This is my actually second appearance talking about Korea's climate change policy, actually third in Washington, D.C., and I know that Washington D.C. is trying to gradually, though, have interest, more interest in the how Korea has been addressing some of the global issues such as the climate change. And particularly because of the active government policy of the Republic of Korea under Lee Myung-bak administration, Korea has been exposed to this world of the climate a lot more than before. And many people are still curious whether or not Korea is willing to, and Korea is actually continuing to pursue this policy under Bakunin administration. And my answer from the beginning is yes, of course. And then I will try to explain about how Korea has been doing this work at the global and regional and national level. I was asked to finish my presentation for 15 minutes, which is a very difficult task, but I will do my best. So let me start with why I want to talk about climate change here in Washington, D.C. Not because climate change is such an important issue. you know, Secretary General of the United Nations took climate change as his one of the very, very important agenda in his term. This is the first time for UNSG actually took climate change as his own agenda. So in itself, it reflects that climate change is very important, of course. And is there any other reason why we want to talk about climate change in Washington, D.C., especially in this forum? And I'm arguing, yes, there are several reasons why. And then I would like to discuss about some of the context, why we are not discuss about climate change in Washington, D.C. First of all, Republic of Korea is a non-Annex 1 country. That's a technical term. That's a developing country under UNFCCC, which doesn't have any legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, along with China, India, and other advanced developing countries, but still a member of the OECD. So Korea has been questioned by many countries why you don't take the legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions because you are an OECD member country. So in other words, Korea has been pressured to take some actions, active actions to tackle climate change. Number two, still Korea has very energy intensive industrial structure, which means that even if we have been working very hard to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by ourselves, but still, you know, the GHG emission has been growing. So there is another reason, and this is similar to the United States. If you see the trend of the greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., and then, you know, there are similarities between two countries. And number three, need for adequate role as a middle power. Korea has been very active, not just as a matter of the a country in Northeast Asia. These days, if you carefully trace the general foreign policy of the Republic of Korea, Korea has been thriving to identify its own etiquette, contribute a role to address some of the important issues at the global level. So in the sense that Korea thinks that climate change is very important. Of course, U.S. has been the leading country in addressing all those kinds of global issues, including climate change. So there could be some issues that we can talk about together. Finally, let me go to one slide. There are two actual statements made by the summits of two governments of Republic of Korea and United States, emphasizing that in the context of the future U.S.-Korea alliance, there are several issues that we can work together in the context of global commons. And I highlighted them. You can see low carbon green growth, clean energy, nuclear energy, and in most recent times, President Park Geun-hye, you know, shared her vision with President Obama here and emphasizing common challenges, including global partnership, Korea's leadership, more important than climate change, clean energy, energy security, development assistance cooperation, peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and nuclear safety issues. Then I have been questioned by myself to what extent all these great political commitments have been implemented, both in Seoul and Washington, D.C. So there is my starting point. And my answer for now is that actually there are more needs for us to work together instead of saying that there are a lot of activity already done between the two governments. So there are several contexts that we can approach, you know, talking about the climate change in Washington, D.C. So here I want to spend a little bit more time to talk about the so-called approaches, you know, in addition to two countries share that the climate change is an important agenda, but there's still some reasons why actually two countries have very good reasons to work on the specific issues to address climate change. And then in this context, we need to understand a bit more about the approaches to tackle climate change. As our chair introduced, I'm going to focus on mitigation aspect of the climate change issues, meaning that why climate change matters, because we emit greenhouse gas emissions, right? So unless you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you cannot solve the problem of climate change. That's the issue of the mitigation, right? So mitigation is an extremely important agenda. And then at the global level, if we want to address the mitigation issues, then you only need probably about the 20 countries. Because top 20 countries will represent more than 80% of the total greenhouse gas emissions of the world. We have about 200, but actually, if you want to tackle mitigation, you need to have about 220. So that's the starting point. Then the question is how we can handle these 20 countries to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So here, usually when I ask people on the street, when you think about the climate change, when you think about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, what should you do? And user answer will be, we have to give legally binding obligations to countries to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Under the UNFCCC, that comes with developed countries. We call them as Annex I countries. Right? So it's very regulation-oriented. And then when I ask people which ministry will be responsible for this issue, and then user answer will be Ministry of Environment. Right? And here in the United States, EPA is pretty much regulation-oriented. Right? Putting regulation so that we have to control the emitting the greenhouse gas emissions. Right? We call this approach at the global level as top-down approach. In other words, countries agree on the legally binding treaties. Based on this, countries have to implement legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Remember, at this time, only developed countries are supposed to take these legally binding obligations. But what's striking is, because I don't have much time to cover everything.
Making me the bully, huh?
According to a study, economic study, in order to meet the target that was proposed by, recommended by IPCC, you have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, how much? About 20 gigatons, 19 gigatons. That's a lot of CO2. Out of 19 gigatons, ask yourself, who needs to reduce more greenhouse gas emissions between developed countries and developing countries? Ask yourself. Answer is, surprisingly, 15 gigatons out of 19 needs to be reduced by developing countries. I told you, developing countries under the UN system don't have any legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, including China, India, Korea, Mexico, Indonesia, Brazil, South Africa. As I told you, we only need about 20 countries from the top, right? Now, number one emitter is China. In year 2030, scientists expect that India will be the number one emitter. So more developing countries are getting more important. Unfortunately, UN system has failed in persuading all these important major emitters actually to agree upon legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As of today, under the UN system, only 15% of the total greenhouse gas emissions at the global level is being covered by this top-down component. In other words, only European countries. Climate change politics is about emission, amount of emission. You emit a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, you are very influential. If you don't emit, then you are not that influential. So LDCs, small island countries are very, very important countries that we have to take care of. But actually, in real politics, they are not decisive factor to bring decisive agreement on how to tackle climate change. So what I'm trying to argue is that traditional approach under the UN system that has been embedded since 1992 actually has not working as well as it was supposed to. So this top-down approach, because countries are not willing to take legally binding obligations. Climate change history doesn't have long history. 1992, many of you here were born before, of course, 1992. So you are the history of climate change, meaning that countries didn't build many practices, actually to depend upon some of the very tangible, things. So climate change area requires, other approaches. That means, this is another thing, why climate change problem happens? Because of economic activities, energy uses, right? So if and why countries are reluctant to take legally binding obligations? Because they think that, taking legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions gives burdens to their society, right? So, you have to change your mind. Okay, if countries are concerned about taking burdens, then you have to make this agenda as a matter of opportunity. So this comes from the one of the famous work of the McKinsey. It listed all those available green technologies, low carbon technologies, right? So in other words, if your country invests your resources to promote these technologies in market, then your economy will grow. But these technologies are low carbon, either energy efficient or renewable, so they don't emit greenhouse gases, or they emit greenhouse gases less. So it will help countries to grow, but as a result, actually you can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It can be applied not only to the developed countries, but also developing countries. If countries are not concerned about the sovereignty, right? Interruption by the treaty, because it's all voluntary. So matters is how to create the institutions, right? Fora, where all these various stakeholders, not only governments, but also private sectors, international organizations, NGOs can work together comfortably. So I think this is the issue, and we call this bottom approach. And the reason why I spend a lot of time to explain about this is that in the negotiation context, in building global architecture, United States has been very, very active, actually in promoting this bottom approach, along with some other countries, including Australia, Canada, Japan, and others. And then they are very, very market-oriented. That's the very big difference between European Union and United States in the UN setting to tackle climate change mitigation issues. Now, because I'm running out of time, all these things can come along with some of the economic planning. Ask yourself again, okay, if you want to pursue this, which minister might be more relevant in your country to deploy all these ideas? Is it Ministry of Environment? No, it's a Ministry of Finance, right? So all these ideas started to be implemented not only by the Ministry of Environment, but rather by Minister of Finance as a matter of economic growth. In Republic of Korea, Korea started to call this, under the Lee Myung-bak administration, as low-carbon green growth policy. So low-carbon green growth policy in Korea is not Korea-specific. Actually, there is a global trend actually to tackle climate change in the context of promoting low-carbon technologies. And then in Korea, it was called as low-carbon green growth policy. Now under the Bakunin administration, we call it as, you know, there are some good linkages between creative economy and what I was just describing about. So I'm arguing that I have been questioned by many people whether or not current administration, you know, stopped very good, you know, initiative by the previous government. My answer would be different. No, we are continuing our policy in a different way, but in a very same context. So Korea strategy, let me finish things very quickly. You know, so Korea set all these things as a national agenda, right, by the previous government. And then Korea established domestic institutions to implement all these policies, you know, such as, you know, Framework Act, and then, you know, introducing legislation on ETS and others. There are many, many legislations which are legally binding on the voluntary basis of Korea. Korea has never been forced by any treaty or any other country. It's voluntary. It's very good. And Korea committed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by its own. So it's very voluntary. It gave a very good signal, positive signal to the world as an advanced country, which is not supposed to take any legally binding obligation, actually started to take this agenda as a matter of opportunity. And then, you know, these days, Korea is very active, not only working on at the national level, but internationalizing all these policies. So one of the very obvious example includes hosting Global Green Growth Institute and the GCF in Korea. This GGGI is supposed to provide planning schemes to the countries, right? This is a new approach. So Minister of Finance is not familiar with how to make plans, right? So there needs to be some organization which might be able to help, especially developing countries, to develop this strategy. And the GGGI is supposed to play the role. I personally serve as a member of the Council of the GGI now. That's the governing body. So we are working really hard, actually, to meet these needs of the world. And the GCF is very, very important. I think one of my colleagues will talk about it a little bit more. Because
Green Climate Fund.
It requires, if you want to implement this idea, then you have to secure your sufficient financial resources, right? So financial mobilization is very, very important. And that comes not only from the public sector, but also private sector as well. Maybe private sector's mobilization will be more important. So we have to work on this. And Korea is the host country. Next week, President Park Geun-hye will be in the United States. United Nations, but you know, she comes into the U.S., right, to go to United Nations to attend climate change summit meeting. Even if I cannot talk about the details at this time, she will play a very, very important role in the summit meeting. And it has been asked by the United Nations to do so because Korea hosts GCF. This is my last slide, if I love, 30 more seconds. So I just listed some of the things. What I'm trying to emphasize, you can read this list. These are things that we can work together in the context of climate change between the Republic of Korea and the United States. Korea is pretty much committed to take climate change as a matter of politics, as a matter of economics. And the United States is the country which tries to tackle climate change using this approach. So I go to climate change negotiation pretty often as a part of delegation. I see a lot of good things in terms of cooperation. But the problem, I would say, or limitation, I would say, is that in the State Department, in the United States, those who go to negotiation actually do not work on the bilateral, you know, side. Right? If I go to U.S. Embassy in Seoul, more diplomats from the U.S. are working on North Korea rather than on this issue. I know some of them, but they are too busy actually to cover everything. So maybe one of the good things for us to be able to think about is the how to mobilize all these good opportunities for the best benefits of the two countries as well as for the entire world. So this is the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
See, I'm really mean. But see, now, see, you've left them wanting more. We're going to do, hold on. We're going to go straight to the next speaker, and then we'll do questions. But don't forget, any questions you have for the professor. And so we're going to move on to, I have to have my people in the back room give us, here it is. Awesome. We'll wait till they do the clicky stuff. That's the wrong one. We need the other presentation for Chung Soo-young. It's the colorful one. So, no, but while we're waiting for them to do that, one thing that comes to mind, you know, when you were talking about the need for bilateral U.S.-Korea, I mean, in U.S.-China, they have, there's Obama, Presidents Obama and Hu had, in 2009, had like 9 clean energy agreements, and that we have this kind of growing kind of bilateral with China on clean energy, which focus, that's still the wrong PowerPoint. Is that the wrong one?
Yeah, that's
the wrong one. I have it on a jump drive if you need it. Hold on 2 seconds.
Sorry, I mean, should I give them the real one? I should give them the right one, right? Catherine, I have the correct one. They have the old one, obviously.
Hold on. But maybe while we're waiting for that, does someone have maybe one question on the Korea climate? But we'll move to Jay's. Okay, that's right. Okay, Jay. All right, we won't do questions. Jay. So because it does make sense too, because he mentioned the Green Climate Fund. I just handed it to someone. I'll come get it. All right. Can we dim the lights?
Yes.
Can we dim the lights, please? They're in another room, so I control the switches. You can go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. My name is Jay Coe, and I'm here to give you a little bit of a tour of the Green Climate Fund and some of its implications for South Korea. Overall, my role here is really as a private citizen. I work for an entity called Siegler Gough, which is a global investment house. But I'm also a member of the private sector advisory group to the UN's Green Climate Fund, and partially providing some feedback to the board of the Green Climate Fund on the design of the private sector facility, which we can talk about briefly. I'd like to add my thanks to the other members of the panels today, to both Mr. Yu and Professor Moon, the CREA Foundation and Brookings, for hosting us. It's been a terrific experience for me, and I hope that I can add something to the conversation here. Very quickly, to give you some background on the Green Climate Fund itself, for those who are less familiar with it, this is an entity that was set up with the purpose of providing support from developed countries to developing countries to limit or reduce greenhouse gas emissions and also to adapt to climate change. What that really means is what's highlighted here in the blue box, which is to channel financial resources to developing countries with the objective of catalyzing climate finance, both public and private climate finance, to actually address two major challenges, which are the adaptation challenge and the mitigation challenge, and to also do it through what's being described as the private sector facility. So what does that practically mean from the high policy level? I'll take you down to a kind of investor's view or a practical execution view of how this is actually being developed and how it might actually work architecturally. The history is that this is first mentioned at the COP back in 2009 in Copenhagen. They established the initial governing instrument in 2011. Korea was selected as the host country for the Green Climate Fund in 2012, and they named a secretariat executive director and opened the formal offices. And you'll see a picture of President Park at the opening ceremonies in December 2013 in Sungdo in the Incheon FEZ. In 2013. It hasn't been until 2014, this year, that first major commitments have started to come into the fund. Korea made its initial leading commitment of $40 million to the entity back in 2013. But by December of 2013, there's only $69 million from any other set of countries that had come into the Green Climate Fund, which again was part of the long-term finance objectives that were set out under FCCC of the UN's objectives, which was designed initially to attract over $100 billion of capital a year. The picture of Angela Merkel is on here because Germany just made a billion-dollar commitment to the Green Climate Fund, which is finally getting to a point of potential operation in the 2015 context, and we'll talk about what that actually means. So what is the Green Climate Fund itself? It has a structure that was set up in the governing documents, which is a little complicated to the outside observer, but might be quite familiar to folks that actually operate in the multilateral context. It has a board of 24 different members, equally split between the developed countries and developing countries, and then another 24 alternates to the board, also from developed countries and developing countries. That sits and governs the secretariat, which is in formation right now, has a headcount today of about 23 people, a number of them consultants, and it's supposed to do three major activities. Mitigation, and a mitigation window has been set up, an adaptation, again, mitigation being trying to reduce the actual greenhouse gas emissions, adaptation being adapting to climate change. We'll hear about a little bit more later today how that actually might happen. A lot of people are interested in figuring out what that actually means. And a private sector facility, which was an important objective of some of the different board members in the creation of this facility. Stepping back into the private sector context, at this point in time, both President Zelik of the World Bank and President Jim Kim have both noted that private sector capital flows into emerging markets now vastly dwarf public-to-public transfers in ODA. So being able to channel private sector capital might be a really important component of trying to address the substantial amount of investment and spending activity that has to happen somehow to address some of these issues in climate, and the private sector facility is supposed to be designed to do that. There has been some controversy in the past about the mix of mitigation versus adaptation activity. You can read about that in the press. And the design of the private sector facility itself has been a question of some debate. What's the private sector facility supposed to do? It's supposed to directly and indirectly engage in private sector finance, private sector mitigation and adaptation activities. So by designing the private sector facility as one of the components of the Green Climate Fund itself, it's supposed to motivate or mobilize private sector finance, private sector actors, in addition to the government actors that we directly integrated into or interacting with the Green Climate Fund through the mitigation and adaptation window, to engage in climate finance. So you can mobilize vastly more capital than might be available to the Green Climate Fund through direct government transfers. The question is how you actually do that. Because it's relatively easy to state policy objectives and debate about the overall strategic objectives, but the implementation of it's actually really important. The idea, in part, is to design a mechanism that changes the current risk and return to investors or to private sector actors from where it is today, where maybe technology, political, and financial risk might outweigh the credit and equity return that you might get from your investment, and by providing guarantees or concessional credit or concessional equity potentially or grants, change that balance of activity so that the private sector will actually act, will step into the market and create a capital flow that will be sustainable over a long period of time. There are some challenges with how you actually do this, one of which is additionality, the idea that you shouldn't just be subsidizing the private sector but doing something that the private sector ordinarily wouldn't do. How you actually go about doing it, what instruments you allow this entity to actually engage in, is it just grants, is it just concessional finance, which are traditional instruments of some of these multilateral and direct development finance institutions of a variety of different governments, including Korea's. And how do you accredit counterparties to this entity? If you stand up this body, again, which has a 24 plus 24 country member board, how does this thing operate with the private sector? So from the private sector standpoint, and my objective is in part to provide that kind of private sector feedback in the design of this, if you imagine the question of how we actually get people to invest, you know, think about whether you would want to get your mortgage from a bank which has 48 different countries deciding whether you should get your mortgage. So the board of directors thought about this relatively relatively long and decided that they would establish what's called the Private Sector Advisory Group, which is, again, a 10-member body, five from the private sector, five from the developing countries, and five from the developed countries, four private sector experts, of which I happen to be one, and two civil society experts, as well as four board members or alternates from the board of the fund itself. And it's designed explicitly to provide feedback and commentary from the private sector perspective on the design of the private sector facility. So here are the questions that are currently being addressed. I'll just give you a quick overview of the practicalities. We don't have to get into the weeds here. But the questions are really, how do you actually design an entity that has these global objectives of addressing climate change through mobilizing private sector actors in many different geographies across many different sets of challenges in a way that's predictable and a way that the market can actually engage with this entity? So if you can imagine, again, a private sector actor that wants to engage in climate finance, having to understand how you engage with a 24 plus 24 board secretariat in a way that's going to be scalable, efficient, and predictable, that's one of the questions that's before the design of the private sector part of the facility itself. There are other separate questions on the adaptation and mitigation part of it. So questions that are being discussed right now are, how do you actually create counterparties for this entity, and how far you go in actually operating the secretariat? Should this, through the Green Climate Fund itself, engage in direct individual transactions or create other kinds of programs or mechanisms to actually reach to the private sector in a way that actually is predictable, scalable, and efficient? And then what types of instruments should it use to actually do that? If you can think about it very simplistically, here's kind of the challenge that some of us are addressing, we've been asked by the board to address, which is, how do you actually generate the huge number of projects, programs, or investments that will actually address some of these issues in climate finance? And you do that through the secretariat, you do it through intermediaries, you do it through local private sector actors and international actors. But then you have to have a mechanism for actually choosing which ones of those you actually execute. And today the mechanism is being considered, whether that should be at the board level. Again, it might be more difficult for a distributed solar installer in Kenya to predict the actions of a 24-member board as opposed to a bank counterparty or a traditional private sector counterparty. So these are some of the issues that are being debated actively right now, which is, how do you actually resource this? How many people are actually sitting in Songdo in the secretariat? How do you actually do risk management for it? And how do you govern it? How do you make decisions about it? The board has so far met on kind of a semi-annual basis. And again, just using the mortgage analogy, if you wanted to choose between getting a mortgage from a bank or from a 24-country board that meets twice a year, you might make it more difficult to do the latter than the former, making it difficult for private sector actors to show up, and the scalability of the mobilization process might be very challenging. So the three questions that have been put to the private sector advisory group right now, which just met last week in Cape Town in advance of the next board meeting of the Green Climate Fund itself, have been discussing ways to mobilize funds at scale. How do you promote private sector actors in the developing countries themselves, most of whom, you know, might find it difficult to get all the way to the Secretariat in Korea or to figure out how to interact with it, particularly in an efficient, distributed way, and what type of instrument should be used in the creation of the interaction with the private sector. So, you know, one of the major issues that's being discussed is if there's only concessional loans and grants as instruments that can be used by the Green Climate Fund, then what about equity investments? What about other aspects of engagement with the private sector, which might be really critical? And there's a long history of challenges when you don't have the full set of instruments that you can engage with the private sector on. Now, what's South Korea's role? Just stepping back from this, and I don't pretend to be an expert on South Korea's engagement here, my role, again, is to provide a private sector perspective as to how this would actually work or what might work or not work better in the design of the private sector facility and its interaction with the Green Climate Fund on the one hand and the private sector finance committee on the other. There are three real axes of engagement or influence that Korea has with regard to the Green Climate Fund. First is governance, and you can see the 24-member board picture at the top there. At this point in time, Korea is represented as an alternate on the board of the Green Climate Fund. I think Mr. Yu Kwang-yeol from the Ministry of Strategy and Finance is the current alternate representative there representing developing Asia on the board of directors. There's obviously a way to influence some of the decisions or participate in the decisions that are being made that come out of recommendations from the private sector advisory group and other discussions about the mitigation and adaptation windows, how governance is going to work and resourcing is going to work here. The second really major activity is funding. Korea was a leader here in providing the first major commitment to the Green Climate Fund of $40 million. The picture that is a little bit of a thumbnail sketch here is of Kyung Ho Chu, who is the Vice Minister of Strategy and Finance, announcing the $40 million commitment, which at the time was the largest commitment to the Green Climate Fund and is now finally getting in a position where they're going to raise more of this kind of financing. The last is the host country status aspect, and I think that might be the kind of most potential but unclear axis of development or influence on climate leadership and climate change out of Korea. So Sangdo Korea was selected as the Secretariat in October of 2012 by consensus. Three of the eight board meetings of the Green Climate Fund have been held in Sangdo Korea, and I would expect other ones to be held there. So there really is a focus on what's going on geographically in Incheon and Sangdo and the FEZ. And how that translates into whatever else might happen is a real question that I think South Korea should contemplate seriously. So what happens in the future, and I'll just be very brief because I'm going to run out of time here. Here's some just thoughts about how things could move forward and how Korea might be influential or take a leadership role or be influenced by the Green Climate Fund itself in the context of global climate activity. The first is on governance, and that is really by using its position as an alternate member. And initially, and additionally, one of those members of the fund governance itself that sits sort of between as a non-Annex I but OECD country, between the history of the development from a developing country ODA recipient to an ODA donor, and that perspective in helping to motivate and make decisions about this, and looking at best practices and thinking through the actual physical operations of this entity and how it might interact with the private sector and government actors. The second is really funding. Korea's already made its $40 million commitment here. It was a leader in doing this. Obviously, there'll be additional discussions about funding coming up. There is the Secretary General's summit next week as part of the UN meetings on climate finance. There'll be a formal meeting in November about the Green Climate Fund itself and donors, and the target objective by the director of the fund itself has been to try to raise between $10 and $15 billion by the end of the year so the fund can go operational in 2015. And finally, the question is here on the host country status. And that'll be a question about how it actually develops and what Korea's policy objectives are really in taking advantage of or capitalizing on or extending its leadership in this area by creating either center of gravity or something else along those lines. So I'll talk about them very briefly. There's some key decisions of the board that are coming up about intermediaries, about types of instruments and flexibility, about funding, about how you actually resource this, like how many people will actually work at the Green Climate Fund Secretariat in Songdo. That will determine a lot about how effective that body can actually be. how you make decisions. Do we really want all 24 countries or 48 countries voting on every single transaction that goes through this entity? I think it might be very difficult to have thousands and thousands of mortgage applications for solar panels in Kenya or Nairobi or Nigeria or, you know, Peru at the board level. So thinking through the right kind of governance structure that will actually make it a viable and attractive counterparty to the private sector is important. And then, you know, how quickly you make decisions and these kinds of things. There will be upcoming board meetings that will happen again on a semi-annual basis. The second thing really is this, this point about funding, where I think Korea really sits at a very interesting intersection. The quote here is from the World Resources Institute, but I think it's probably a generally shared view that Korea is sort of in an interesting position as a country that's really sitting, having rapidly developed in a developing country context in the context of the Green Climate Fund, but one with an OECD perspective. So, you know, for this little Venn diagram here, I'd sort of say that of all the bubbles here, you know, the big blank ones are China, India on the developing country side who have not made any commitments to the fund. The big empty bubbles on the left side, on the developed country side, are the U.S. and the EU and Japan, who also have not made any commitments to the fund. Germany has. France is expected to do so in advance of the Paris COP next year. But so far, it's $1 billion and then $40 million from Korea and then a few other drips and drabs of commitments that have come through from other places. Korea really sits on that bubble because it has that perspective of rapid development, but also having come from a developing country context and development country context as well. And the last bit really is about this climate ecosystem. And I have a question mark there at the top because I don't know what the answer to this is. So just very simplistically, if you look at the center of this whole diagram, this cloud of potential ecosystem or expertise that could be developed in South Korea or might develop in South Korea, you really have the Green Climate Fund's headquarters itself. It's the secretariat sitting in Sungdo, South Korea. There will be staff hired for that entity. The number, the quality, the type of staff will have to be decided by the board. And again, Korea has governance issues around that or government influence over that. There will be both private sector and public sector advisors that will grow up around the fund itself as it actually executes on adaptation and mitigation window strategies, as well as engages with the private sector. Now, what happens beyond that will be determined by what the shape of each of those actual executions actually is. So there's the potential to build, you know, think tanks and NGOs around this part of Korea or in Korea more broadly, because you will have a center of gravity of an actual execution resource there. I mean, whether this becomes something like the Asian Development Bank or whether it remains an allocation entity with a very limited number of staff is a very open question. That might influence how Korea actually geographically develops in this as a center of gravity for this kind of activity. And then finally, you know, other aspects like the Global Green Growth Institute are being co-located in the same area. You have the World Bank's offices and the IFC's offices being located in the same area. Will there be kind of this nexus of thought leadership, private sector engagement, financing capability? I think these are all questions that are potential by the fact that Korea is the host country and will be a locus of focus for the board itself, and certainly as the secretary becomes operational, however it becomes operational, might be potential there. But those are choices and questions for South Korea to take in this context. That's all of my slides right now. I think the basic point I'd like to make here is you're in the process now of watching the Green Climate Fund become operational. Korea has taken a lead role in that process by being one of the lead early committers to this. And has a governance influence over it, as well as this special host country status, which could be translated into a broader center of gravity for this kind of activity. How operational this entity really will be and how effective it will be at mobilizing resources, both public sector resources and private sector resources, particularly in becoming a credible, transparent, reliable, efficient counterparty to the private sector, will be absolutely determined by the decisions taken by the board and the entities going forward. And if it becomes more complex, more bureaucratic, less difficult to predict, less difficult to interact with, then there will be a substantial opting out by the private sector in favor of actors that are much better at predicting how countries vote and bureaucratic institutions operate than maybe how climate finance efficiently gets done. So I hope that it's more of the former than the latter. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you so much. I'm gathering my questions. You guys gathering your questions? No sleeping out there, okay? I know you're just had lunch and all, but you've been fed, so use that energy. Grab more coffee if you need it. Pop that Coke. All right. You have the correct PowerPoint, because this is the cool PowerPoint, right? The first one was your draft.
And just so you know, that the first two PowerPoint presentations will be online. Not yours. Yours is a not yet published piece, but Jay's, he actually had like a whole bunch more slides with lots more details. So you can get, you'll be able to catch that online at Brookings. All right.
All right. So about 3 years ago, I was talking with one of my co-authors. I was working while we were working on the IPCC report, and he said I went to DC, and all they talk about is mitigation. Lately, we notice more climate-related or weather-related disasters that occur frequently, as well as a burgeoning of adaptation plans around the world. So in this context, I want to focus today on national adaptation planning and the role of soft laws. So to illustrate this point, I want to compare France's and Korea's national plans. So mitigation is basically to halt or slow down climate change. So they have basic emission targets and a binding treaty. Because of the nature of the binding agreements, it's stalled. Adaptation assumes that there will be inevitable climate change. So we want to prevent people from maladaptation. And it is society-wide, so it includes health, disaster, food and water security. And when this is done fully, it restructures the whole society, or that's the end goal, in the direction of sustainability. It's also longer term than sectoral policies that you see today. However, this does not have any targets like emissions do. Instead, we have national adaptation plans with guidelines and recommendations, and these guidelines are imprecise. And these are the attributes of something called soft laws. Soft laws tend to be non-binding and imprecise. And we see these examples in transnational governance. International declarations is one example. Conventions, memorandum of understanding are all indicative of soft laws. Domestically, we can see in the US, for example, congressional resolutions. In the private sector, this is akin to corporate social responsibility. So why use soft laws in adaptation planning? Climate change adaptation is just too uncertain and complex. It involves many sectors. Adaptation is also locally driven, which means that we have to deal with numerous local biophysical and social conditions. Therefore, it is very difficult to set a specific target like you see in the emissions. How do France and Korea use soft laws? Well, both of them place a higher priority on mitigation. It's represented in the French climate plan and also Korea's low carbon and green growth framework. So this is the French framework. So let's see, the climate plan usually refers to mitigation, and then they have a separate line going on with a national plan that's preceded by a national strategy. Both mitigation and adaptation converge at the regional and local levels. In actuality, regional climate change plan incorporates mainly mitigation actions, not adaptation. In the Korean case, it starts with a broad framework, which is translated into an act on low carbon and green growth. And then adaptation, I think related clauses are two articles are there out of all this, articles on green economy and green growth. So it constitutes like vulnerability assessment and climate change scenarios. You can see, it's difficult to see because all the writings are small, but there is only one category Number three, that's funded for adaptation. The rest are all has to do with the mitigation and green economic growth.
And this is a 5-year plan underneath Korea's low carbon green growth.
Act. Yes, this is the first 5-year plan from 2009 to 2013.
Okay, good. So make sure.
Thanks.
Since they couldn't see the time print.
So main strategies that France and Korea use to build up their adaptation plan for the nations are two. One is mainstreaming. Mainstreaming basically is the integration of climate change impact into existing policies that relate to health, forestry, coast, ocean, disaster, and so forth. So in this slide, it's a French one, and it's a national adaptation strategy for the sector on biodiversity. So you can see in these three columns, they use the integration word. Integrate the challenges of climate change into existing biodiversity conservation management policies. Integrate new principles and tools into these same public policies. Promote integrated governance. So the word integration basically refers to mainstreaming. And you also notice that these are very general statements, not necessarily enforceable regulations that local and regional governments can do with. Adaptation is also centered on something called risk management. People see climate change as a threat rather than an opportunity. Therefore, they want to manage this risk. And you see how it's translated into the vision policy in Korea's plan. So on the very top line, there's human health, which one sector they want to adapt to. And it says protect people from heat waves and air pollution. So there's word protection, which is part of risk management. Disaster, minimize damage. Agriculture, switch to adaptation. And this one is more of an opportunity. And forestry, improve forestry health. With ocean, respond to sea level rise and secure stable marine resources. So these are all parts of response and recovery should that climate change impact occur in a large scale manner. How do France and Korea differ in their adaptation planning? So France, they have a gradually developed the national adaptation plan with detailed strategies. So national strategies that accompany vulnerability assessment and climate change scenarios preceded the plan itself. So strategy occurred in 2006. The plan was established in 2011. This plan is a policy document, meaning it has no legal mandate. Korea developed this plan rather rapidly, so they didn't get deep into the specific strategies. However, the plan contains two binding articles. Despite some differences, the end result is similar in that they have some shared implementation dilemma. So one is lack of knowledge. This basically means that when it comes to the field government officials who have to implement these policies, they lack knowledge. They don't know what to do because the national plans are so abstract and general to be of much use. Secondly, there is lack of enforcement. There is no monitoring, no evaluation criteria, and no penalty for to assess the lack of compliance with these policies. Lastly, there is a problem of mainstreaming. it is in principle a very good idea to integrate climate change impact into sectoral policies. However, there is room for misuse in the sense that they mask existing policies as adaptation measures, maybe to get some more funding or to raise their performance score. And in reality, they actually do nothing about climate change adaptation. So, as far as soft laws are concerned, with implementation, it hasn't performed well. What it has done, this is a quote from a French geological survey scientist. So far, adaptation planning has provided people with directions, and people know what can be done one way or another, flexibly. After all, this is continual adaptation. There is no terminal point yet. Soft laws, therefore, serve as information rather than as a tool to change behavior. Thanks.
Okay, thank you so much. Well, you guys just threw a lot of information at them in a very short period of time. You guys okay out there? Is there an instant question, or can I ask a question first? Are you you're desperate? Oh, the back row is going to let me ask a question first. I appreciate that. Well, actually, I've got lots of little questions, and I'll probably insert them in. I guess first one is, because we started this panel is created with the premise, it's all Catherine Moon's fault if it's not right, but that maybe that Korea really is a leader on climate. And I see some hints of that here in the panel. But here's, and so I'd like you to just respond a little bit more quickly. You know, is Korea really a leader? Because you said that in terms of mitigation, but has, you know, like we look at China, and while China's, you know, their energy consumption is still exploding, but they have made lots of effort, and they have really slowed down. They're still growing, but they're growing their greenhouse gas emissions at a much slower rate. Massive investments into clean energy technologies, which is maybe that's why they're not involved in your G. You know, they're doing their own kind of green climate fund within China. But I'm wondering, Korea. So, you know, is Korea? Are you seeing results so far in Korea lowering the mitigation? And Somin, you mentioned that there were two binding provisions on the adaptation. I was curious what they were, but also. I know you just compared France and Korea, but can you step back more broadly? Because I know that I'm guessing the people in the room are like me. Is any country a true leader on adaptation? Or in the U.S., we call it resilience. Did you know that? Have you noticed the word resilience coming up a lot recently in this country? It's more of like resilience strategies. And Jay, I guess my question to you, well, I mean, you were the one that kind of got me thinking. You said that being a leader, potential leader in this Green Climate Fund. But I was wondering, are there any other models for the private sector? Are they, when they built this, was there a model for the private sector to follow in doing this? Or are they just really, I don't know, made it up as they went and forged a new path? Because there are a lot of international financing mechanisms, but yours sounds unique. All right, down the road quickly. Starting with you.
I think there are a lot of potentials where Korea can play a leadership role in tackling climate change. As I said, both global and regional, even national level. If you see the structure of industry in Korea, Korea is almost number one in petrochemicals, shipbuilding, and automobile. We are very, you know, strong. So in other words, many of the key industrial sectors are all energy intensive. So that gives Korea another good opportunity, not burden, by actually indicating that, okay, these companies can develop their industry activities not only based on what they are doing now, and also they can see the future trends. For example, Korea is very strong in shipbuilding, meaning that Korea can be very strong in wind power, for example. So there are good potentials. In the sense that there are many good signs, and surprising enough, all those large companies in Korea, including LG and Samsung,
they are not influenced by governments in the developing their business plans, actually. They already done that at the global level. So it's a matter of how to coordinate, you know, regulatory policy and some of the good plans that are already available. And then from my side, what I'm trying to tell this, especially to the government, is that, you know, it's a matter of building the good regulatory regimes at the global level. So we have to actually, you know, invite the private sector's investment so that we can make the floor. And then that needs to be done by public sector. So that's why G20 is very important, because G20 can be a very good place where we can get 20 major emitters together and discuss about the climate financing issues. Climate financing is responsible, you know, is an issue that needs to deal with the Minister of Finance. If we go to UNFCCC, there are Ministry of Environment. So they cannot actually work on this. One of the innovations where UN, United Nations system has made in the context of creating Green Climate Fund is that it's a matter of shifting the focus from Ministry of Environment to Ministry of Finance. Legally speaking, GCF is attached now with under the UNFCCC. But still, it's almost getting independent. So there are a lot of things. And the Korea, in this sense, you know, in terms of the making global institutions, are hosting two major international organizations. These are major international organizations. The likely size of GCF is $100 billion, you know, US dollars. It's a similar size of the World Bank. And the Korean people don't know this. So we have a lot of
potential.
But
also, have to note, we must note too, I think, is that, okay, in the United States, we don't have a climate policy. Right, there's been action being taken by the states and President Obama pushing the Clean Air Act to really start working on greenhouse gas emissions. But we don't have a climate policy. We don't have a, you know, coherent energy policy. But Korea, you do have a climate policy.
Yeah, we are developing.
I'm pushing
policy.
You up here.
Yeah.
This is good. Yeah. You know, Korea, that you have a climate policy.
Because we see them as opportunities, not the burdens of the society.
And you're not arguing about it between your different...
Well, we are arguing each other.
Okay.
But there are a group of people...
Okay.
Group of organizations which firmly believe it's a matter of opportunity. It has gained a lot more support from the society, I think.
Okay.
And then there are good reasons why the Korea needs to work together with the United States on GCF. This is not well known, but when the Korea was tries to host the GCF, it was possible partly because of the support of the United States at the last minute.
But so, we didn't fork over the cash yet.
So there are many, many items that we can work on.
Yep. Great. We'll come back to you.
Okay.
Two binding articles. They are one on creating adaptation policies and plan for it. Second one is implementation.
Wait, what was the first one again?
So establishing national adaptation policy.
Okay, just establish.
Yeah. Second one is implementing it. Yeah, so it's very general at this point. There's no detailed plans, and they are in the process of making them at the regional and local levels. So any country that's a leader in adaptation planning, if that country has had a big weather-related disasters, yes, that place becomes a leader because of urgency, and because they see the reality of not adapting. So for example, New York City after Sandy has accelerated climate change impact and its integration into their existing policies. Mayor's office has a separate climate change adaptation, a forum of some sort. Also low-lying coastal areas. So small island nations are very dedicated to establishing adaptation plans because this is something very real and urgent for them. So I think there has to be some climate extremes event. And second, it has to be urgent in order for countries to come up with a good adaptation plan.
Has Korea, because again, my ignorance, I can give you examples from China. Has Korea had any kind of Sandy equivalent, or you know, where other, because I think it is important to note that a lot of times it is the cities that are at the front lines of dealing with the climate impacts, and you see in the United States we've got regional
some states that have come together around climate. Anything similar, rumblings
Koreans,
in Korea?
Not similar, but Korean has had a frequent floods, coastal floods, and also river floods, river-based floods. And recently, Korea is trying to establish a new ministry for disaster management.
Okay.
So that could be, the climate concerns could be integrated into that one.
Thank you so much. Okay, now Jay.
Yeah, I don't have an informed opinion on what the implications on Korean leadership might be in the climate sector, aside from the fact that there is this potential because of its governance aspects, its leadership that's already shown on the funding side, and its host country status, which creates the potential for the center of gravity. Now, what happens to that, I think, will be a matter of how that entity actually evolves, how it's organized, how it's resourced, and how it actually gets managed. You asked a question about models for the private sector to interact, and I don't mean to say at this point in time that there isn't a plan or a strategy or that this is a very unusual way to structure an organization. There are many precedents for this type of structure, and there are things like the World Bank, the IFC. The United States government has an entity that I served in called the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which is part of the development finance community. There are similar entities in Korea. In all the OECD countries have development finance institutions that promote investments into emerging markets. Each of these entities themselves is already engaged in with the private sector in sponsoring investment and trying to crowd in investment into credit activity and equity investment activity to promote renewable energy, efficiency transactions, lending, distributed power generation, and so on. So there are a lot of these models, and part of the work that's being done right now as the Secretariat and the operations of the Green Climate Fund are being set up is to take some of those models and try to apply them, to take the best practices in terms of flexibility of instruments, in terms of governance and decision-making, instead of replicating early challenges that have been faced by the evolution of some of these institutions. The one other point I just wanted to make quickly is you said, you know, I won't opine on whether the United States has a climate strategy at the national level, but I think the point about municipalities and states is actually a really important one. So New York State and California both have renewable energy and climate-oriented strategies. They're increasingly moving towards market-facing interactions at the local level. There's a green bank in New York. There's a green bank in the UK, which are designed to try to crowd in private sector capital, either through credit transactions, through green bonds and the like, or by co-investment or convertible equity into the actual risk-taking parts of these transactions. So there are a lot of different models for this. I think one question that's being faced right now at the Green Climate Fund is how much should that entity do itself and how much should it partner with a lot of existing entities and just deploy capital or allocate capital to those entities.
And I know that it's still being set up and you can look, but, you know, I don't know, like looking in the crystal ball, but just in general, like thinking about what the business sector, if you're looking at, you know, mitigation and adaptation, which is more attractive? And, I mean, part of me thinks, well, where are they going to make the most money, right? Or, you know, because sure, adaptation would be, if you're concerned about your business, all businesses need water, clean air, you know, risk, you know, for them, risk mitigation. Which direction do you think that the Green Climate Fund, do you think they may... You mentioned distributed solar a few times, so it seems more like renewables mitigation strategies.
Well, I'd say that I think two things. One is there are three separate programs that are being developed under the Green Climate Fund, a mitigation window, an adaptation window. Both of those are considered to be country strategy level interactions with the Green Climate Fund, so primarily public sector finance. The private sector facility, which will interact with the private sector, I think will be an evolving animal. I don't think climate change is going away or climate finance is going away, and I don't think we're at the end of the story. I think we're closer to the beginning or the middle of the beginning of the story. So if you think this is going to be around for 20, 25 years or longer, then what might be important today or investable today, which might be most obviously renewable energy and mitigation and these kinds of activities, might, you know, be much more commonplace later on. And what might be needed in the next phase might be investments around the right business model for adaptation. Like, do we help finance more green buildings? Do we help finance more power resiliency in the grid? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, part of, I think, the private sector's input into this process has been try to set up a flexible mechanism that you expect to be able to change over time, because the market will change over time. And your interactions with that entity will have to change over time, too. It's very difficult to change your fundamental documentation in terms of what you can do and how flexible you are in your ability to do it.
So the more inflexible you are at the beginning, the more likely you're going to have to come back and have a conversation about it later on or create another entity that will face the next set of challenges. So the easiest things to see right now are investments around mitigation because they're project finance oriented, mm-hmm. solar power, wind, efficiency transactions around insulation. Distributed solar is an easy one to think about because it's a project. You can do it in a big scale, you can do it in a small scale, and so on. But the question is, what would you invest in adaptation?
Yeah,
is that just better roads? How do you invest in roads? Some countries you can own the roads, some countries you can't. Better ports, same thing. Insurance for low-lying hotels. I mean, is that mitigation a mitigation solution? I mean, so I think we're at the beginning of discovery of what that actually will be like, and whether there are investable business models around that, I think will be to be determined. I would expect that there would be. And that's why I think at this point in time, if you're really setting up an entity that will have this kind of long-term operation, particularly from the point of view of folks in South Korea where you could be creating a center of gravity around this activity, you'd want the maximum flexibility to start out with and the most predictability from the point of a market actor so that 20 years from now you aren't wishing that 20 years ago you had had more flexibility because the challenges are completely different, the way the market looks is completely different. And how you interact is completely different.
Okay. If I may...
Just real quick with these guys. They're getting rusty.
Sure. So can I...
You can tell.
Right. I think what Jay just mentioned can be elaborated in the context of climate change institution building process. Everybody in this room should know the Copenhagen meeting, right? If you go to that time, this is almost the first time where actually group of countries, start to see climate change as a matter of economy. So they agreed on Copenhagen Accord, where if you carefully read them, there is a striking agreement. Number one, short term, a small amount, to cover both mitigation and adaptation. Long term, large amount, $100 billion by 2012, only for mitigation. Then next meeting, important meeting was Cancun. You go to the negotiations, and there are a lot of small countries. They saw that they are losing their opportunities. So they started to talk about mitigation and adaptation. As a result, anyway, it goes on and on. And then now we have a Green Climate Fund. So Green Climate, if we go there, then they always talk about balancing mitigation and adaptation. But if GCF will focus more on the mitigation, I don't think GCF will have bright future. Because innovative system, in terms of financing, financial mobilization, is to draw some of the interest from private sector. So as Jay said, unless you focus on mitigation, it's very, very difficult for you to bring the money from the private sector. According to a statistic that I saw, large one, is €500 billion every year to tackle climate change. You cannot get the money from private public sector. You have to bring private sector. So that's why climate change is a matter of business.
All right, so gather a few questions here. Hands high. Is there a microphone? Okay, the gentleman in the back who zipped his hand up first. I'm going to gather like two or three questions, depending on the length. But let's try to keep them short because we've got just 15 minutes, and then we're going to...
Hi, Lauren Hershey. I'm an attorney, semi-retired now. I thank you very much. Each one of the panelists gave us an abundance of information. An abundance of information. It's incredible. The GCF, I had never heard about it. You said the South Koreans have never heard about it. Has there been publicity widely about the creation of this fund? And also, will it be funded at $15 billion, as Mr. Koh said, or at $100 billion, as Mr. Chung said?
Okay, that's one question. Remember, don't answer right away. Pass the mic just right in front. We'll do little clusters.
Hi, Hyo-won Shin from the Wilson Center. I would like to ask a question about Korea's leadership regarding climate change. I know that there are a clash between developing countries and developed countries regarding their obligation on how much CO2 they must reduce, but developed countries, they are arguing that it is that developing countries like China should take more responsibilities And China and developing countries are saying that the developed countries have a historical obligation to reduce CO2. So Korea, who has an interesting position, which is in between of the developing and developed countries, what kind of role should they take to relieve this incoherent thinking between the two groups of countries? Thank you.
Okay, and right next to you.
Sarah Koh, and a non-resident fellow at Korea Foundation. Actually, I want to kind of maybe switch gears a little bit, and since we're talking about green politics, I wanted to kind of mention green diplomacy and green politics, how this would actually work if we could use this to maybe bring a policy-oriented thing for North Korea, because I know North Korea is suffering from a lot of issues, including deforestation. Do you think that it's a possible, maybe soft power for six-party members to kind of encourage North Korea to back to the table through using these green initiatives?
Okay. So succinct answers. The first one, let's go to the GCF one about, did anyone?
Yeah, to be very clear about it, the Green Climate Fund was first mentioned at Copenhagen in 2009, very publicly. What it would look like, how it would be structured, what amount would be done was not entirely clear. There was a target set up at that point in time to do $100 billion in what's called long-term financing under the UNFCCC. There was a fast start target of $30 billion in a shorter time frame that was designed to encourage the developed countries to actually mobilize capital more quickly, both private sector capital and public investment and public spending. The targets that I talked about are, just to be very clear, not my opinion of what the right amount is or what the amount will end up being. It's the explicit target that's been set by the director of the Green Climate Fund herself, which is to try to raise between $10 and $15 billion by the end of this year. So there have been some preconditions to the operation of the Green Climate Fund in the setting up and design of that structure, which are now being voted on by the board before it becomes operational, and it now may have the potential to become operational in 2015 after it fulfills these preconditions. So it's now just starting to get into the fundraising phase, and we'll see how successful that is. The Secretary General's summit next week on climate, and then the formal meeting in November to try to gather commitments, additional commitments from donors, will show you whether or not that has been a successful mobilization or the design of this actually has been successful. So there's, 24 plus 24 members on the board. They represent different countries and regions. There have been expressions of potential commitment from people like Brazil and I believe also South Africa and Mexico. Indonesia committed some capital to the fund. Korea has had the largest commitment until Germany's recent announcement about a month or so ago. So it's not that China's opting out or India's opting out or the U.S. is opting out or anyone else is opting out. They haven't really been that formally asked yet, and that momentum will gather, or we'll see if the momentum gathers in the kind of next few months. And a lot of that is thought of as a potential precursor to how successful 2015 discussions might be and the success of the Paris COP in 2015. But I don't have a great opinion on that. We're just here to provide a private sector perspective.
And I think with the second question, I think we could be brief because in some ways many of the people, what they were talking about was specifically about Korea's leadership in doing the GCF and their commitments to 30 reduction of 30% of greenhouse gas emissions. Was there anything short you wanted to add to supplement her question about South Korea's leadership on it? I think, but what about the Korea Foundation woman's question about good reaching out to North Korea? Of course, it has to be a North Korea question, right? Is this a good avenue?
Well, I published a research report about that topic, actually, in English last year. So earlier this year, Minister of Ministry of Foreign Affairs reported to the President Park Geun-hye about one of the plans of the Foreign Ministry to implement a so-called Green Detente through Global Green Growth Institute. It's very surprising. The per capita emission of North Korea is way above than the average of the developing countries. And there are many good reasons. So one of the main reasons why they don't have energy resources, so they are cutting trees. So that's the main reason. So that's why you mentioned about the deforestation. This is the exact area where actually we can work with North Korea in the context of Korean Peninsula Trust Building Process. And then we have a great organizations immediately available in Seoul. That's the Global Green Growth Institute. So if you work on Korea itself, then you can draw the global, you know, attention immediately. So there are even good items that we can work on.
But even thinking too, though, of, you know, China, yeah. Right? I mean, China, you know, maybe you guys don't focus on China's environment, but China really has, they've been the number one investor in clean energy technology for the past 3 to 4 years. Number one installed wind power. It's actually now, it wasn't initially a lot on grid, now it's on grid. They installed more solar PV panels than we have in the United States now. They're doing it again this year. They'll do it again next year. And so, and it makes me wonder that is China even, I mean, I know they've talked to North Korea about, you know business models.
That's a matter of political economy, though. If you go to UNFCCC negotiation, then China represents the developing countries groups, which is basically favoring not taking legally binding obligations. That doesn't necessarily mean, that, as you said, that China actually doing a lot of good things
of
at the domestic level. So China has been puzzled, actually. So they have some sort of political interest, right, in defending the general, you know, interest of developing country as a whole. China belongs to China, G77 and China negotiation group. That's the largest group. If I were Chinese leader, I don't have any intention to give up, you know, this good political benefits. But at the same time, at the domestic level, China is almost number one in solar panel.
I mean, they're choking,
the global level,
right?
Right.
The air pollution, huge problem.
So here, the question is how we can internationalize what China is doing at the domestic level. So that's the question and answer. It requires a lot of time to explain, but is an emphasizing bottom approach.
Yep.
You know, making countries feel comfortable on what they are doing and institutionalize them at the global level. Don't attack a sovereignty of China. They will not follow you. So encourage them and bring the institutions where China can comfortably, you know, play on the game.
Okay, we can take some more questions. This side of the room is going to revolt unless I call on them. So how about these two questions here? Good questions so far, people. I'm glad you were paying attention. All right, pressure's on. I just talk anyway. We'll listen. Speak loudly.
Alex Forster with the East-West Center here in Washington. First of all, whether or not Korea has had any sandy equivalent, GCF is built on reclaimed low-lying coastal land, so let's hope that they don't have a sandy equivalent, or GCF might be very directly affected. And as far as how seriously Korea is taking the environmental issue, I think the disappearance of all the Korean media that were here for the earlier panels also is a little bit of a testament to that. That said, Korea is going to implement on January 1st one of the world's most ambitious environmental trading schemes as it's currently laid out. It might have a carbon price of over $90 a ton. There are fears, though, that that could lead the system to collapse because it's too robust. It's based on previous business-as-usual estimates, which have since been revised upwards without changing the specs of the ETS. So I was wondering if any of our experts have an opinion on ways that the ETS itself could be modified, any improvements that should be done before implementation. And also, I also published a proposal earlier this year for how North Korea could improve its environmental system through microgrids and distributed wind energy to reduce that deforestation issue.
I think for the general audience, in case they don't know, ETS is about, you're talking about carbon market.
Carbon trading, exactly.
Carbon trading, just want to make sure.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Okay, hold the answer. We got another question. I pegged you already there, Professor. Clearly a Korean expert here in the audience.
Yes, thanks for your presentation. But I wonder if you can really emphasize more on technology and less on the financial private sector partnership, because that's a lot of feedback and flaw and things like that. And then currently, if you want to say like IMF, Madame Lagarde, and she and her staff will do a wonderful job on the cost of pricing the pollution. That's a very good concept in an economic sense or political sense or policy sense. And then I also think about an environmental group. I think if you can follow them, you can help propaganda in this sense, public message, is reduce the gas pollution or drilling or fracking. They will help the green and climate change. And now they are going to have a big march on NYC, and that's a good news. You know, UN Secretary is going to be there to be a leader in the march. So just very wonderful things. And the concept of the private partnership is can be always, basically always abused, especially by the think tank. And even in any public sector, if you have a message you want to bring out or debate, they don't allow you to debate. Instead, like think tank, they don't allow you to debate. They take they say social media account off. So that means only those who want to propaganda for something, they can talk, but general public, environmental group, or public citizen, they cannot. So this will be very biased.
Did you have a question?
My question is, would you please help the message out about a real technology sense and then put every effort? You know, the top 1% of wealthy people, they have a lot of money. GE have a lot of money to do a green investment. You don't need, they take the private sector's home and then borrow, they take money to the GCF. You don't need this.
Okay.
Thank you.
So do we have... maybe one more question? Yeah, we have to cut this one. Okay. So on the first one, the CO2 emissions trading scheme.
Yes.
And then I'm going to modify, pull something out of her question that's good for us here. Okay.
Okay. I think I need to be very quick. So as far as I understand, I am not based in Seoul these days. I'm based in Paris temporarily. So I might be not 100% accurate. But as far as I know, that the Korean government is scheduled to launch the ETS as planned. But it will give more concessionary deals to the industries. So by giving more free allowance, that's what I was told. So meaning that Korea will be the first developing country in the world which actually on the voluntary basis to introduce this very important carbon pricing scheme. So Korea will be the first case. And then I know that China is following very
closely. China has some regional... Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, China's so big, right? You know, they're just one province. It's like, okay, they've been doing experiments in some of the provinces on CO2 trading.
There's some topic of leaking the Korean one eventually.
I think that would make a lot of sense. Now, one thing that from her comments I thought that we didn't really mention much here today, I mean, you, Jay, you had a little box about how NGOs might be involved. I was curious in terms of Korean environmental NGOs, are they active in terms of working on you know, pushing climate mitigation, climate adaptation? Just real quick from you two here.
Well, to understand who favors what depends upon what kind of expertise you have. Most of Korean environmental NGOs are ecologists, so they favor the adaptation issues. So they favor adaptation issues. There are a limited number of NGOs who pushes the mitigation issues to a large extent as a matter of making opportunity.
Really? That's the opposite here. So they focus on adaptation?
They emphasize adaptation. Mm-hmm. And mitigation-wise, they, of course, you know, saying that the industry needs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but their main focus, I would say, lies in adaptation.
Is that in terms of what you looked at, adaptation?
Generally, NGOs focus more on sustainable development, and adaptation is considered at the forefront of that field. I think going back to the North Korea and developing country questions, I think vulnerability reduction has to precede mitigation. Otherwise, importing green technology to the developing countries or North Korea may not be very useful if these countries do not have absorptive capacity. So in order to get to that capacity stage, you need to at least reduce the physical and social vulnerability of the place and adapt to potential harmful effects of climate change first, instead of importing green technology that they may not be able to utilize without a lot of training.
And Jay, on your little box, when you had NGOs being advisors, what kind of NGOs are you talking about? You talking Natural Resource Defense Council?
No, I just think that when you create an entity like this, it tends to attract people that are going to try to influence it and be thought leaders around it and counterparties for this entity. Just like You know, the World Bank and the IFC are located here. There are a lot of people that interact with it. It can create kind of a center of gravity for those types of individuals. If you create a facility that actually deploys capital, the decision-making about that will attract people that want to get some portion of that capital or to interact in a way that actually is more predictable with the entity itself. So I'm just saying that that's a potential outcome from the design of this this institution. I think the technology point is a really important one, actually, and lends itself more towards the flexibility of design of this program. If you imagine the technology that exists today, I mean, like, solar PV prices collapsed over 85% in 18 months. Why? Huge investments by Chinese solar photovoltaic manufacturers, which have now led to some trade disputes with other countries as well. But the financing for that technology, the mainstreaming of it, the collapse in pricing for it that allow it to be more compatible or more competitive with existing power, all that requires capital, requires expenditure, requires risk-taking. The implementation of any kind of adaptation strategy that requires the building of infrastructure, whether it's seawalls or more resilient homes or more resilient agricultural crops, that's all going to require someone to spend money someplace. So if you want to pool all this capital together, you have to find out a way that will, over a long period of time, be flexible enough, transparent enough, efficient enough to deploy that capital in a way that doesn't require a lot of cost, that is predictable, and that is flexible. And if you don't, then you'll be stuck with whatever technology was available at the time when you froze that entity's ability to act. And I think, you know, that would be problematic, and you would have a completely different energy mix. You'd have a completely different even building mix. I mean, one of the points here is sort of this adaptation mitigation debate has become a debate, even though both of these are strategies that will inevitably get done by people in the private sector and people in the public sector sort of automatically. We talk about green buildings today, right, energy-efficient buildings today. I mean, isn't kind of the end state here 5 years or 10 years from now just to have buildings that all are a lot more energy-efficient rather than ones that are greener than other ones? Because it's more cost-effective, because it's more, because it actually does reduce your operating costs and these kinds of things, or get technologies that are so commoditized that you don't even think about them as differentiated. So there's aspects to what will be important at this stage and what you'll get the best return from in investing in, whether it's upgrading, moving from diesel power, diesel fuel, coal, fuel oil-oriented boilers and energy generation in the United States even, versus what would be important 5 or 10 years from now. So I think that's the important point.
Okay. Well, while the Korean news media scurried off, you guys hung out. They appeared engaged. Could we thank these people for their really good talks? I believe there's an announcement. Yeah, James Person said he was sorry he couldn't come.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk to him.
Well, he had to go to Amsterdam for some unknown
reason. I'm very happy with the course of our panels and our learning and our thinking and mostly our debating. I'm very glad that our audience was able to, throughout the day, have a chance to air their thoughts. I am running through, from morning to now, and I think it's interesting because we had what seemed like random topics, but they're actually not. We started the morning with a regional focus on security, conventional security and economics, in the context of the U.S. rebalance toward Asia. So a regional focus and conventional issues that are of concern. And then we moved in midday to a panel that helped us think with more focus and a deeper analytical purpose to issues that are particular to the Korean Peninsula. So the nuclear North Korea problem, as well as unification. So we go from region to a focused, detailed view at the peninsula, and issues that also, out of the peninsula, realities that have big implications for the region and for the world, whether it's unification or whether it's the continuation of nuclear development in the north. And then our last panel at the end of our afternoon leaves us with a much more global
View, a panel that looks at shaping the world and country policies now in order to create a more sustainable, livable, enjoyable, prosperous future for everybody, not just the Asia region, not just the Korean Peninsula. And I like ending on this note because it is a way to tie us all together. And when I think about the U.S., South Korea, Japan, as we started off in the morning, we had added bits of China, issues about China in unification panel. And then, of course, North Korea and the pivot, et cetera. We need to think about ways to connect these issues and these countries on practical measures that actually people can take on and try to move forward. Nuclear dilemma, this is a tough one. We all know it. We may not succeed in 5 years, 10 years, I don't know. Unification, another tough one. 5, 10, 20, 30 years, I don't know. But regardless of the challenges of improving our world in terms of climate, environment, I see ways that Americans, Koreans, Chinese, Japanese, and possibly North Koreans can find openings. That is, as, was it Sonia? Sarah. As Sarah from the Wilson Center had mentioned, North Korea does care about the environment, maybe not from an ethical perspective the way some of us, some of the environmentalist types might, but from a very practical perspective, because it's been deforested, as we know, from the Great Famine, and because for any kind of economic reform, development, or sustainability to make sense in North Korea, you need to address the environmental issues. I visited the North in 2 summers ago. We were brought to this steel, a fertilizer-making factory. And that factory is one of 2 factories that puts out synthetic fertilizer for agriculture. So it is a major part of the so-called agricultural development of North Korea. What mortified me was the smell of ammonia everywhere. And the North Korean manager took great pride in explaining how, you know, this process of converting ammonia into fertilizer with the other chemicals, you know, it's so important and it's very, vital to the nation. Yeah, it's vital to the nation. But I was trying not to breathe when I was standing there because I felt poisoned, literally, right there. You don't have to go far. This was Hamhung. It's a major city. And so we're not talking going into the woods or lack of woods. We're talking in everyday places in North Korea. The environment is something in many ways. Many types of environment issues are things that we could take up. As many of you know, next week there will be big coverage over the human rights issues in North Korea. I consider environmental rights or environmental issues also part of human rights. And most human rights scholars look at environment as part of the larger umbrella of human rights. And if we look for ways to help North Korea think constructively, positively, and potentially toward a yes rather than a no, such as environment perhaps, we may make more progress than hitting them over the head with the very large questions about human rights violations that are so explicitly political that we already know their responses to. So I think those of us who have more information and have a better understanding of the way the world runs need to really be good psychologists as well as good analysts, policymakers, scholars, writers, and think about ways to bring North Korea, Japan, China, South Korea, the U.S., and, of course, the rest of the world, toward issue areas and toward practical measures that actually can deliver something. I want to thank everybody for staying. Those of you in the media who stayed, can you raise your hands? Yay! From Seoul Shinmun. I was shocked, and I'm going to email some of the colleagues in the media today or tomorrow maybe and tell them, and you know, you should have stayed, because their job is to report what's going on now, and their job is to report problems, right? When this panel was so busy on what's going on now in order to prevent problems in the future and to fix the problems of today, they needed to be here. And I also think that it's very important that people know that South Korea is not just about nuclear weapons, about North Korean problems, and about unification problems. South Korea is such a rich, rich resource of so many issues and developments to study, to enjoy, to explore. I tell my students anywhere I go when I'm talking to students, study South Korea as a case study for anything. Because whatever your issue is, you'll find it there, okay? And in that light, I think it's very, very important to acknowledge that South Korea, as a government and as a private sector, have been moving very explicitly toward a green economy and toward abiding by green principles. And it is one of the few countries, again, without being forced to, has voluntarily made so much progress. And it is an area where South Korea truly is taking on global leadership, global leadership role. So in that sense, it should be celebrated. I had hoped to learn a little bit more about President Park Geun-hye's emphasis not only on the sources of energy and finding alternative sources, but she also wants to emphasize the consumption end. And we didn't hear about that, but we'll leave that for another conference. So I think we're ending on a very positive note about South Korean leadership, not just following and being stuck between China and Japan and Russia and the United States, not being just harassed by North Korea, but a society, a government, a private sector, an NGO world that actually can move forward on these issues that that affect the entire world, not just the Koreas and not just the region. So I give very big-hearted thanks to the Korea Foundation, to President Yu, and all of your staff who have worked very hard. I give huge, huge heartfelt thanks to my colleagues at Brookings who worked literally night and day to make all this happen. And I guess I should also thank the Johns Hopkins SAIS building. There's no leader here, representative, but the building. But since our auditorium is being remodeled, you'll be able to enjoy it soon. But we were lucky to have this wonderfully large space with good accommodation. So thank you all for staying and your participation.